You're listening to The College Connection from New England Public Radio. I'm Casey Gilman. The College Connection is a series of lectures from visiting and local speakers given and recorded at the five colleges. This forum provides an opportunity for listeners to engage with the researchers, intellectuals, poets, and authors active within our academic communities. Majora Carter is an American urban revitalization strategist based in the South Bronx, New York. In a recent visit to Hampshire College, she spoke about the importance of considering how the environments we build affect the people who move through them. Her work focuses on what she calls low-status communities, places where there is generally considered to be a low quality of life. These communities often bear the cost of the society's environmental burdens, sites like mines and dumps, while enjoying less environmental benefits than any other. Carter's talk was recorded on September 16, 2016, at Hampshire College. Special thanks to Hampshire College's Media Services and Communications Office for the use of their recording.
Hello. Thank you. And it really is kind of fun to be in the alma mater of my husband, James. Where'd he go? Oh, hi, baby. There he goes. And in particular, it was really funny kind of walking, or rather driving in here with him and going, that used to be an apple orchard. Wait, there was a road there. Wait, I mean, change happens, people. It just does. And it was definitely kind of interesting to see it through his eyes. And so I have to say, and thank you for bringing me here and all the rest of you. But you know, but I know this is a really fascinating and interesting and wonderful time for the people here at Hampshire, because you really have done something really incredible with the building of that of the current center. But I also know that it has provoked a little bit of controversy here as well, as anything of value, I think, does. That's just the way it works. And in particular, you know, just the idea of justice is something that I've heard a lot bandied around, and you know, how it's being interpreted and what does it mean. And bottom line is, justice means very different things to different people. And you often hear the term, you know, after search words such as environmental or racial or climate, reproductive. And these phrases are really meant to illustrate a struggle for equality in their respective areas. But there is a gap. And this is where it gets kind of tough for people, because, again, different people view it differently. And there is absolutely a gap between how the dominant culture and the subdominant culture looks at the word justice. To those who, quote unquote, have, justice sounds like you might be taking something away. It sounds like punitive measures. It sounds like revenge, whether it's warranted or unwarranted. And to the have-nots, it's an expression that's often used, you know, because people are frustrated with the present, but often don't have a clear view of what the justice they seek would actually look like. And to those who dedicate themselves to the principles of environmental justice, there are very long and elaborate definitions with a dozen or more points and lots of demands in terms of what that actually means. So again, if you're not part of that world, how are you going to know? I like to think of the work that I do simply as a strategy to increase the quality of people's lives in areas that aren't considered quality. In other words, those are low-status communities. And those are the places, whether it's an inner city ghetto, a Native American reservation, a formerly profitable but now, you know, former mining town. Those are the places where the status of the people that are in them are not really considered all that. You know, they are the places where you'll find the kind of, like Sutterly, where Jason was from, that was talking about last night. This was the place where mining happened. And people were all a part of it, but it was also the place that didn't look really lovely at all. You know, people were sick. And so those are the things that happen in places like that. They're the places where the environment is not so great. There is lower educational attainment generally. People's health outcomes are poor. And all of those things coupled together means that the status of the people in there are generally lower. So my version of equality, again, is all about how do you create quality in the lives of people in those areas. So 10 years ago, I was actually given the opportunity to launch TED.com as one of its very first 6 online videos. And I was so excited about that. And the site's actually surpassed more than 1 billion views, and it's part of our educational culture right now. And so you only get 18 minutes in any of those things. And so it was important for me to get to the point. And my main point was simply that no community should have to bear all the environmental burdens and enjoy less environmental benefits than any other. That really was the principle of that. And that's what we want, and we want to continue to go there. But it led me to a following conclusion that I was able to deliver at actually the very first PowerShift conference. I think back in 2007, the line there was, if we had sited our transportation, our energy, our waste infrastructure in wealthy communities as easily as we did in poor ones, we would have had a clean and green economy a long time ago. And that was a visual, that I was hoping people would kind of see. And I think they did. But the body of my work has largely been visual. I'm a project-based person. I'm also a former film major from Wesleyan University, right down the road. So I think like that. Who's from Wesleyan? Who that? All right, there, girl. So another one, yay! So there we go. So you know how creative and visual we all are. So that's cool. But seeing something happen in a place where nobody thought anything would happen, that is like the coolest drug ever. Not that I've taken that many drugs to begin with, but I could imagine, like, if it is a high that you want to keep having. But building things is a truly important kind of thing to see happen. And there's nothing like it in the world. You know, that sexy new building, which I think is over there, I can't see through the wall, over here, thank you. Is now part of your environment here. So again, I look at environment in terms of how it affects the people moving through it. Are they going to be positively or negatively influenced by what they see, hear, eat, and breathe? And the reason why I like working toward equality is because regular people walking down the street, going from where they live to where they work or where they spend their money, can actually see and feel equality or inequality from those places and in those places. And it affects everything about them. Does it make them feel like they're included in something special and something beautiful? Or does it make them feel like they're inferior and that the world knows it and is constantly telling them that? The latter is often what you find in the built environment in low-status communities. You have to design and build projects to know if it even works or not. And yes, granted, you almost never have enough money to do everything you want, and especially if you're a woman, and definitely if you happen to be a Black woman, speaking from experience, you never have enough money. But you can get something done, and you can learn from how it works or it doesn't work. And projects never please everybody, especially those who have never launched projects themselves. Because I know from experience, it's also a lot easier to run your mouth than it is to run a business. And sometimes I'm just, if I can get my little digs in there. And we refer to those type of people as CAVE people. CAVE stands for Citizens Against Virtually Everything. So believe me, I've had all sorts of CAVE people. They are at me all the time, and thanks to social media, so there we go. But I want to show you a couple of the ways that I actually worked really hard to help shape the built environment in our own backyard. Hunts Point Riverside Park was a former dump. Literally, it was a dump that dead-ended at the Bronx River, which I didn't even know there was a Bronx River until my dog pulled me down into this place. But now I know that there was one. We transformed that thing into a park, and it went through several iterations before it became, this glorious award-winning park that it was. But when I first started, there were plenty of people, mostly behind my back, saying things like, "Don't we have enough problems? Why are we building parks? Like, that's just stupid." Okay. Because we were actively fighting against waste facilities in the community. And to me, being a visual person, was just like, we need to give people something to fight for and not just against. They need to see in their own community something that is beautiful and that makes them feel likewise. Give them a space from which they can stand and feel like they deserve something better. Don't just tell them that their neighborhood is crap. Not that it wasn't in some cases, but give them something to like dream on. And that's why we did that. And the people said it couldn't be done, and it was done. And one of the first events held there was the wedding that I held with my husband and married him there back in 2006. With regard to economic development, we know that we are part of the tech economy in this country and all over the world, and I kept hearing these things about how what we need to do is like teach kids to code, and that's how we're going to get people into the tech world. And the nonprofit industrial complex really supported training in the tech sector, and that was pretty much it. We're going to teach kids to code. I think kids should learn a lot of things, be taught, you know, music, art, chemistry, physics, science, you name it, how to be nice to each other. Good, teach them to code too. But what I really thought we needed was actually entry-level jobs in the tech sector that could provide career ladders that were preferably in those businesses that were located in low-status communities, so that were owned by people in those communities, so that we could do away with statistical hiring bias in tech. That's what I thought we should do. And people were like, good on you, kid. Good luck. And it was a real challenge as a black female tech founder to find support to make that happen. And my husband and I really almost went broke trying to develop what we knew would be a business that would respond to a pain point in the tech industry, which was software testing. And I'm not going to go into all the details of that, but we were basically able to urban onshore some tech jobs here, add some value so that companies in this country, in New York City in particular, would find value in hiring our people to do that work. And we owned the actual business, so we just gave them a service. So they weren't bringing in people into their office. Instead, those folks in a street corner office in the South Bronx were inspiring other people in the community to understand that tech could happen in a low status community like the South Bronx. And 2 years later, we're doing quite well, but not before we had to do the whole really difficult couple of years to grow a tech business with very little funding. But yeah, we're going to be 2 years this month, so we're really excited about that. Another thing we did was we launched a coffee shop. And in some parts, you know, I think in the world of folks who like to think that gentrification is just this absolute bad thing with nothing absolutely good can happen. And when you look at it in a very traditional way, when it just displaces poor people, yeah, it is a difficult thing to say. But we knew and understood that gentrification didn't just happen, you know, when, you know, hipsters and other white people move in and the doggy daycare centers came in. Okay, that's not when gentrification starts. Gentrification starts in low-status communities when we start telling the smart, hardworking kids in those communities that in order to be somebody, you need to grow up and get out. You will measure success by how far you get away from those communities. You stay here, you will be like the rest of them. Nothing. That's when gentrification starts to happen, because what it does is that it leaves this widening investment gap. Because instead of the people looking back and going, we can invest in our own communities, it gives speculators and other developers opportunities to go, I can get that land cheap, because those people living there, they see no value in it. But once they're gone, this is going to be prime real estate. I saw it happening in other neighborhoods all over the country, certainly in New York City. And I was like, you know what we're gonna do? We're gonna do this thing called self-gentrification. Because the last time I checked, people, poor people in communities, low status communities, we like nice things too. We want parks. We want our schools to be better. We want healthy places. You know, we want to go to cool, we want to feel beautiful in nice places. We want to shop in our own community and not, you know, and get good, decent food and not be overcharged for it. We want good things. Why would we not? Doesn't everybody want these things? I mean, do you have to be wealthy to like see value in good things? That's just only cave people think that. And so self-gentrification became something that I really do believe in. And actually, I didn't make up that term. I got it from President Carter from Johnson C. Smith University down in Charlotte, North Carolina. But I love the term, so I've adopted it as an approach. And so as we were thinking about how do we create investment in our own community, one of the things that we did was we heard, because we've done hundreds and hundreds of surveys talking to people about what do they want in their neighborhood, what would make it so that you don't want to leave, so that you don't feel you've got to move out of your neighborhood to live in a better one. And little things like coffee shops came up, restaurants, things like that. So I was like, and with my limited capacity, I realized what we could do is we can open one if we developed a joint venture with somebody who actually had the knowledge to do coffee. And so we joined forces with a really awesome company called Birch Coffee. They've got 7 different coffee shops downtown, known for some of the best, and they are high-end specialty coffee. And we were like, okay, we're going to partner, we're going to do this joint venture, and we opened this absolutely beautiful little coffee shop right on Hunts Point Avenue, which is a block away from where I live and down the street from where I grew up, and it happens to have been the very first coffee shop that we've had in our community since I was in high school there in the 1980s. There's been no place like that, and no place for like even adults to hang out in, unless, of course, you're interested in topless bars, because you can find those in the outskirts of the neighborhood, but nothing else. So again, we wanted to give people something else they wanted. So we did that, and it was a really kind of, it was that kind of third space that's accessible for anyone to meet and talk and gather, and we just launched it less than 4 months ago, and we're doing really well, too. But I did upset some people. I woke up one morning on my way to spin class, and I look at this little mural that I started, and on it was a sticker, and it said, actually it's right here, because I took it off, but it says, my quote, we believe that what we're doing is called self-gentrification. That's our approach. And it was attributed to Majora Carter, local sellout. I'm gonna put that on a t-shirt and sell it, okay? but the idea, again, that we don't, it was like, oh, and of course it was a little coffee cup on the top of it, referring directly to the coffee shop that I'd started. But again, those kind of things were the important pieces that really allowed our community to see itself as valuable, whether it was a park, whether it was a tech company, whether it was a coffee shop. People were just like, wow, I didn't know I could get something like this in the South Bronx, in my own neighborhood. Why can't we get something that we want in our own neighborhood? That should not ever be a question that we can't make these things happen so that things are beautiful for all of us. But those are context-specific kind of projects. But I do hope you see the kind of parallels in work that you do and what you observe and what you choose to support or not. None of them will bring about justice, whatever that means. But they all can be bridges to equality as you define it. My friend Bill Clinton once said to me, there'll never be a time when there's no distance between where we are and where we ought to be. And the Kern Building, I think, in my humble opinion, will actually help narrow that gap. It will certainly start some conversations. And I hope, you know, the kind of conversations that will actually bring people closer together than it will, you know, pull them further apart. But it's up to all of us to carry its meaning and its purpose into other parts of our lives and bring a little bit more of equality day by day everywhere. And so thank you very much. And I understand now we've got some time for questions, if you like. Oh, and there's some mics going around.
Good morning. Thank you very much. That was a terrific talk. I really enjoyed it. So I'm an architect. I work in an urban center in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Mm. Some of you might know about the city. It's been down on its luck for a few decades. And one program we started recently was we're partnering with the state to do a receivership program, where we go into communities and we take over abandoned properties, and we actually work with the local community to restore those properties, turn them into affordable housing units, and then we turn them back over to the community. So we receive home funding from federal and state grant programs. But I'm now on my third receivership property, and I will say in New Bedford, the list is probably 50 or 60 more right behind it. Mm-hmm. So there's no shortage of work. So having only done three of them, I will say one real shock to me was when I would show up at the properties, the community members would start coming over to the building. And even though it was abandoned or might have been vacant for a decade and really they're in difficult condition, to put it mildly, they got, what can we do to help? Mm. It was always this offer, what can we do to help? Can we help you clean out the building? Can we sweep the sidewalk for you? Can we? And what we've started doing is partnering with these local youth group programs to get the youth and to get these individuals from the community in to help us actually clean out the buildings and do some of the work before we start actually doing the construction or the restoration work on the properties. And on one building in particular, the local community actually sent out they got the community to sign a petition saying, we want that architect and her community developer to restore this building because it means something to us, not because it means something to the potential home buyer. Mm. So instead of these buildings being demoed and developers picking up the land for dirt cheap, the state in our little town of New Bedford, Massachusetts, has begun to say that's worth something, and we're going to save those buildings and turn them back over to the community. So I thought I would just share that story.
That's a beautiful story. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. My name is Joanna, and you mentioned about the lack of funding. And I wonder, from a systemic point of view, and since you're an out-of-the-box thinker, do you have some ideas about how the funding could go differently? Because I love out here in Western Mass, they have community development corporations, CDCs. And I know some of the little Hilltown CDCs have been quite effective. But how can there be different private and public funding sources that come and are more available, so that when these buildings come up, when there are possibilities to move forward, the money is there to be tapped? Can you give us some suggestions?
Oh, I think the money is there. I just don't think that they trust Black women to spend it well. Straight up.
What's your best technique to deal with cave people?
The problem with cave people is that they're just really cowards. But they are, I'm sorry. But when given an opportunity, even if I don't have the opportunity, first of all, I love them. I have to, compassionately, because I don't want to be in a position where hateful thoughts are growing in my heart and in my life, because eventually that's when bad things start to happen in general. But when I do, I mean, I am constantly, and like, if you do ever bother to look at my Twitter feed, you know, when I'm attacked in ways like that, you know, about things that, like, I would love to talk about, I'll invite people to meet with me. I absolutely, like, I will walk up to, if I see people, I'll walk up to in the street and say, you know, I understand that there are some issues, we should talk. You know, maybe I could learn something from you. And I absolutely I'm really, really good at that. And I would say that 19 times out of, no, I'd say more like 99 times out of 100, most folks will not respond. But that one does, and it's worth it.
Hi.
Who's talking? I just want to see who you are. Oh, yeah.
Hello.
Hi.
So the coffee shop sounds like a really cool idea, or like a cool like thing that you've, you know, created. And I was just wondering, like, how did you make it affordable for the entire community? Like, is it affordable for the entire community? And like, if it is, like, how did you get there with such high-end coffee?
It's the same cost as Dunkin' Donuts. And people love Dunkin' Donuts. Our coffee is bangingly better than Dunkin' Donuts. That's all I'm saying. But no, we made a point because we had to do that. We knew that, and impartially, it's like our rent's cheaper. You know, if we were in the middle, like our partner in for their 7 coffee shops, their rent's like 20 times higher than ours is. So our customers can actually feel the benefit of it. We employ locally. I mean, everybody who works with us is literally a local person. And actually, one of our co-investors, there's actually co-investors from the community that invested in it as well. So there's it is a locally owned coffee shop as well. So the money is just circulating throughout the economy. So yeah, cool. Thanks.
I thank you for your inspiration. I was wondering, you said you talked to people to see what they wanted. How did you make that happen? Who'd you talk to?
Oh, like literally about 500 people in the local community. We, you know, on my own dime, as part of my company's outreach, collected surveys, we did focus groups, we just asked people, and again, this was my money, you know, as a private LLC, because I really wanted to get feedback and intel. And in part, to be straight up, it was a bit of a CYA, because I wanted to be clear that, because I knew knew nobody else was doing what we were doing in terms of getting feedback and input from the local community and making it really clear that we were soliciting advice and interest and understanding, because we wanted to be clear that, you know, we had some ideas, but it was like, this is what we're trying to do. You tell us what else you want to see happening, and we're going to try to make sure we match those things. And that actually grew into an advisory board where their goal literally was to give us feedback on our projects that now does its own, but ultimately the data that we received absolutely fed into each and every one of the projects that we do locally right now.
Mm-hmm. Hi, right here.
Thank you.
So I work for a youth-run environmental organization, Greening Forward, and we've had some...
Did you say Greening Forward?
Yes.
Oh, Charles Orkborn?
Yeah, hi. Yeah. He says hi, by the way.
Good. give him my regards.
Yeah. And I know we've had some connections with the Bronx River Alliance before, mm-hmm. and I've actually met some really awesome young people involved with that. And I was just wondering how you think youth can have a voice in this, because I'm a strong believer that young people have a lot of power within their communities. So I just wanted to hear your thoughts on how we can empower young people.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, they already have power. I mean, and I think one of the interesting things about, because I do a lot of speaking whenever possible, you know, with whether it's colleges, but also at the local level at many different organizations. And part of the reason why I go is to help them understand that, you know, just because they happen to be young, that they don't have something to say. And I want to share my story, you know, coming up from the time when I was their age and saw no value in my own community, which is one of the reasons why I left it, to go to college and then just to not be anywhere near it. But when I came back, it was a part of how do I make this community what I want to be? And I really try to encourage folks to understand that they're sitting in a spot right now, especially since, you know, they're the ones that ultimately, frankly, that I'm trying to appeal to right now, because I do want them to think about their own communities as places that they can return to. And I need their help in terms of understanding what makes it better. So we took a very, very deliberate, part of our strategy was to find out, you know, what young people actually wanted and what they thought was important. And really listening and hearing them say, you know, that there wasn't anything here, there or there for them. And that's why we literally started building what we did. So I feel like I've been incredibly responsive, you know, to the kind of things that, you know, make young people want to be a part of a community. And, you know, my goal is that they actually pay it forward, you know, and continue to inspire me to think more broadly and more creatively for them.
We have time for one last question right here. Hi, my name's Alina, and I'm from Los Angeles, California, and grew up in, I guess, like a low-status community. And I'm actually really curious about your shift. I'm an artist, and I'm really curious about your shift from film to environmental justice and how, like, those passions are still intertwined and connected, especially as, like, a 23-year-old, that, like, life can go anywhere.
Yeah, sure can. That's what I like to hear 23-year-olds say. Like, not like, oh, my God, what am I doing? I was like, you can go anywhere you want. I mean, you've got no babies and got no husband, got no, or wife, whatever. Just do your thing. So, yes, amen. God bless you. But, I mean, I you know, so here I am. So I went from being an artist, and I'm still an artist. Straight up. I think the work I do is, it is art. And I say that because, you know, what does an artist do? An artist imagines a world that, whether you're looking at a canvas, you're looking at your body as, you know, as a dancer, you're creating something that just wasn't there, and trying to inspire people to think about the life that they're in right now, that just, even if it's just for that moment of the performance, of the what, looking at your piece, that something has changed in their minds and in their lives to make them feel better or different or inspire them to do something. And, you know, as a real estate developer, as an urban revitalization strategist, that is what I do. So I'm still an artist. Thank you.
One more? We have time for one more question.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. First of all, thank you.
Thank you.
I want to check my assumptions. And I'd like to know what the conversation is with people who say local sellout.
Honey, I wish they talked to me. Seriously, I would really like that. But they're, I think, on a bunch of levels. Like, these are the things I think. I think, one, they're afraid of success. I think they've been told that success cannot look like me. I think it makes them feel bad that they, because I don't think, I think they know that I know I'm no better than any of them. But somehow or another, I was able to accomplish something simply because I tried. And I think it makes them feel bad. And that really hurts on a bunch of levels. I mean, in part because there's another human being, or unfortunately, there are quite a few human beings who feel like my success is their failure. And that was never my intention, ever. And it also makes me sad because it tells other young people that you can't be something from a community like mine and stay there. Which means that the communities never get better. And that's why we're in the position that we're in right now, all over this country. Because, yeah, I mean, at the South Bronx is my research and development lab, but I've been around this country, I've been around this world, and there are South Bronxes everywhere. And we go through the same exact things, and I don't care what color they are. If it's a low-status community, it's a low-status community, period. And we like to think that, you know, well, you know, we do little things here, we do little things there, we put a Band-Aid on a problem and suddenly it's fine. Or we, like, you know, argue about the difference between equality and equity, and then, you know, that's going to keep us busy. It's like, let's get busy doing some work and changing the lives of people, for real. Thank you. I'm feeling incredibly, like, really tender in the heart right now, because it is hard. It is really. There are times that I'm like, why do I keep doing this? Seriously, why do I keep doing this? It's like, I know. And then I realize, like, you know what? People feel like somebody gives a crap. And I'm told that in so many ways. And it keeps me going when other things hurt. I am gonna put this sticker on a t-shirt though.
You've been listening to The College Connection from New England Public Radio, a series of lectures from visiting and local speakers given and recorded at the five colleges. You can find more College Connection online at nepr.net or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. For New England Public Radio, I'm Casey Gilman.